Well, welcome back. Any of you are new tonight, welcome as we dive into our second week of looking at this class on Christianity and the Middle East. Well, let me start with prayer. Lord our God, as we turn our attention to the lands east of the land where Jesus trod, and we see the news in the recent weeks and months of the catastrophe being suffered by your people who are there, our hearts go out to them and our hearts go out to you. And we ask that you would watch over them, that you would preserve a people there who, for your name, that you would give them courage and grace. And as we look back into history, I pray you open our minds and to give us understanding. And we thank you that we follow that what we believe in is events that happened in history, that you sent your Son into this world to walk upon this earth, and to that certain things happened in history of which we are the great beneficiaries. We thank you for that. Bless us with your presence, we ask in Jesus' name. Amen. Last night, Sue and I had some friends over for dinner. Sue has known the wife for 30 years, and they work in Kurdistan. They work here in Duhok, way up on the Iraqi, Syrian, Turkish border. That's where those three countries meet, right there, there in Duhok. And this area here is Kurdistan, sort of a semi-autonomous protectorate that was carved out by the Allied forces beginning in 1991, the first Gulf War. Saddam Hussein had tried to, had been attacking the Kurds, and the Allies imposed a no-fly zone in this region here, and then they got their own, this protective area. And they're a people group that is longing for independence. So this couple, Greg and Chris, have been working there. Chris has been working with Kurds for 30 years. She initially with Kurdish refugees in Berlin. And then 4 years ago, they moved permanently there. And they visited us a year ago and said, come to Kurdistan. Come and visit us. Come and work with us. And we go, well, isn't it a bit safe? I said, oh, no. It's safe. It's safe. Well, how do we come see you? And they said, oh, just go to here, Diyarbakir, and get on a bus and just take the bus across the border. So after they left, I looked around on the internet and found that actually quite a few people, the more adventuresome backpackers, do take that route in, get on a bus, and just go across the border. And Kurdistan is doing very well. They have been the big winners out of the last 20 years. There have been plenty of losers, but the Kurds in general have won. So they work up here with Kurdish Christians, Kurdish churches. We'll get much more onto this later in the course. The Kurds don't really have any long history of Christianity. Other people groups in the area do. And they are surrounded by Assyrians, many of whom are Christians, and by Chaldean Christians. Both of these are part of the Church of the East that, as we saw last week, really got going within just a few decades of the birth of the church in Jerusalem. And then there are also Yazidis living in their area, the Yazidis that we have suddenly heard about because lots of them got stranded up here on Sinjar Mountain. There you see Sinjar there. So where the Yazidis were on that dry mountaintop was in here along the border. So they're in this place that there are Christians there, rapidly declining population of Christians, but Christians with a nearly 1900-year history. So it was fascinating talking with them all evening. And were they still around, I would have had them come and teach this class tonight. But they have flown off to Berlin today. But next time they're back, I'll have to see if we can work it out something far enough ahead of time to actually get them to come and talk about what it's like working in Kurdistan with Christians and with of all sorts of different flavors. And as part of what they do, they go and they they cultivate relationships with the Assyrian Christians. So they go to Assyrian Christian services and Chaldean Christian services, as well as Protestant Kurdish services, and they know a lot of people. Then they told me about a video that I would like to show you. I have planned to show a few videos through the class. Sort of the logical place to put them would be all at the end, when we get into talking about what about the Christians in the last 20 years, because obviously that's when most of these videos are made. But I thought, well, we should intersperse them a little bit along the way. So this is about Iraqi Christians in peril. So a lot of the stuff we talked about last night, and quite a few of the people in the video, are people that they know and people that came up in our conversation last night. So, Iraqi Christians in Peril, that was made for Germany initially. You might have gathered that from a few of the references, because Germany has a lot of Kurdish people there, a lot of Kurdish Christians. Iraq, until 2003, 10% of the population were Christians, and that has declined precipitously. This was made in 2012, and the situation is much worse today. At that point, 500,000 Christians have fled. Now, 2 million Christians have fled, and there's 500,000 left. At least those were the last figures I saw, and those are probably out of date quickly. And our friends Greg and Chris, are seriously concerned that the Middle East is going to end up with no Christians pretty soon.
How about Christian Kurdistan higher?
It's higher in the sense that Christians have fled up to Kurdistan, so it's increasing percentage, but they've fled from other parts of Iraq because Kurdistan is the only safe place for them to go. Well, and then lots and lots of them have fled to Jordan, and they were fleeing to Syria. And of course, Syria is no longer a good place to be, so they've then been fleeing back. Well, where our friends are in Duhok, that's where that international school is. That was featured at the end of the piece. Okay, well, let's move on then and look at the handout. The handout really is a continuation of the chapter that you got last week. It's still looking at the first three centuries and finishing off some other matters before we can move on to where everything changes with Constantine, beginning in the year 312. So, first thing I'd like to look at, what were the attitudes of the Christians within the Roman Empire? So first of all, what were the attitudes of the Jews? And then what were the attitudes of the Romans? From the point of view of the Jews, initially they saw Christianity as a sect of Judaism, just like the Christians saw themselves as a sect of Judaism. They were the sect of the Nazarenes, the Nazarene, and we saw last week how that name, Nazarene, has carried on over into the Jewish community even today. It's a Hebrew word, and into the Arabic world and into the Syriac world and throughout the East, that's the word used for Christians. And it was in the Greco-Roman world in the West that the word Christian was used. So they saw the Christians initially as a sect, just like the sect of the Pharisees and the sect of the Sadducees. Both of those groups we read a lot of in the Gospels, and in Acts those are both described as sects. And then Josephus tells us about the sect, not only those two sects, but also the sect of the Essenes. So in the first century, there was sort of multiple Judaisms. So you can't just talk about one sort of Judaism. There were several different flavors of Judaism, each with some quite different ideas. And in the Gospels, we see the Pharisees and the Sadducees, and in the book of Acts, having some argument about things. Paul viewed them as a sect that should be suppressed. And so he got, with approval from the high priest in Jerusalem, he went off to Damascus and other places to persecute the Jews, the followers of the way. And the fact that he got authority from the high priest showed that they viewed this as, this was sort of an internal argument within Judaism and came under the authority of the high priest. And that high priest had the authority to write letters to synagogues in Damascus and other places saying, you know, these are heretics, basically, within our Jewish community and should be suppressed. So help Paul do that. So things carried on until the year 66. And in 66, the first Jewish revolt broke out. Trouble had been brewing for decades. The Jews were chafing under Roman oppression. And finally, sort of boiling point got reached in 66, and this revolt broke out. And the Romans responded to it with a pretty heavy hand and ended up defeating the Jews and suppressing the revolt. They captured Qumran in the year 68. That's where the Essenes were located, out in the desert. They captured Jerusalem after a siege in 70, and they destroyed the temple. And then they captured Masada in the year 73, and that's where the Zealots had been making their last stand. And that was a devastating blow for the Jews and for Judaism, the different types of Judaism. Several of the sects died out at that point. The Essenes, centered in Qumran, died out when their community was destroyed. The Sadducees, centered around the temple in Jerusalem, they were the wealthy who were in profited off of Roman occupation. They died out. The Zealots, who were the ones that led the uprising against Rome, they died out. And the only group of Jews to survive were the Pharisees. They had to leave Jerusalem and go and figure out what does Judaism look like without a temple. That was a bit of an issue, given the centrality of the temple to Judaism. And they went, tradition has, that they went to down to the coast, to a place called Yavne, or in Greek, Jamnia, and convened a sort of council, and the rabbis got together, and out of that came rabbinic Judaism, which was based around the oral law that we read about in the Gospels, the tradition of the elders. They developed this oral law, and eventually in the mid-second century wrote it down. It got written down into what we know as the Mishnah by a person called Judah the Prince, Yehuda Hanasi, while the rabbinic council at that point was meeting in Sepphoris up in Galilee. And then that rabbinic council moved to Tiberias. And that rabbinic Judaism developed into what nowadays we would recognize as being Orthodox Judaism or ultra-Orthodox Judaism, centered around the keeping not just of the Torah, the law in the Old Testament, but all these additional laws that were viewed as being part of the oral law. That really, you can trace this, the straight line from Pharisaism into Rabbinic Judaism into Orthodox Judaism today. Now, as the Jewish revolt was being suppressed, or as during the Jewish revolt, all the Christians in Jerusalem fled. And the Christians were Jewish, and they fled across the River Jordan to a place called Pella, which is one of the Decapolis cities. And that, to the Jews who were resisting the Romans in Jerusalem, became, as it were, sort of this final sign, see, you're really not part of us. You're really, when push comes to shove, you run away and you don't express solidarity with the Jews. But they were heeding the warnings we get in the Gospels, when Jesus warns, when you see the army surrounding the city and so on, and then Mark adds in, let the reader understand, and we get these warnings. They took those seriously and fled for their safety. Now, at some point in the next couple of decades, as Pharisaic Judaism was becoming rabbinic Judaism, a curse against the heretics got formulated, and it was written into the 18 benedictions, and this is a set of prayers that every Jew, that observant Jews, say three times a day, the Amidah, which means standing. So they stand up and they recite these, what are still called the 18 benedictions, except there's 19 of them. There's been 19 of them since late first century. And what was the 19th one that got added in is now number 12. And it expresses this curse on the heretics, the Menim. And then some manuscripts we have say, and the Nutzrim, and the Christians. So, for the apostates, let there be no hope, and let the arrogant government be speedily uprooted in our days. Let the Nutzrim, that's the Christians, and the Menim, that's the heretics in general, be destroyed in a moment. Let them be blotted out of the book of life, and not be inscribed together with the righteous. Blessed art thou, O Lord. Really, at that point, Judaism, Christianity really go their separate ways. In the year 132, there was another Jewish revolt, the second Jewish revolt, sometimes called the Bar Kokhba revolt, because this individual, Bar Kokhba, or Ben Kosiba, was acclaimed. He led the revolt. Rabbi Akiva, one of the prominent rabbis of the day, acclaimed him as being the Messiah, and Jewish hopes rose. The Romans responded again with a heavy hand, suppressed the revolt, and this time they did a more thorough job on Jerusalem. I remember in 70 they destroyed the temple, and this time they plowed the Temple Mount and made sure that it wasn't going to be have a temple rebuilt. And Hadrian, the emperor at the time, rebuilt the city. He completely changed the layout of the city and rebuilt it as a pagan city, Aelia Capitolina. And on the Temple Mount, he built a temple to the Roman gods. The current layout of the roads of Old City of Jerusalem follows the pattern laid down by Hadrian in 135. The Jews were expelled. They were not allowed to live anywhere close to Jerusalem. They were allowed to continue living in the land, and a sizable number of them stayed on living up in Galilee, and that's where the rabbis met and had their rabbinic courts for many centuries after that. But there ceased to be any Jews within Jerusalem itself. Now, the Romans considered Judaism, they didn't particularly like the Jews, they didn't really understand the Jews, but they had learnt that they needed to recognize the Jews as Judaism as being a legal cult, what they called a religio licita, a licit, or religio lecta, a licit religion. And they accorded them certain privileges. They didn't have to fully participate in emperor worship. And I'll get onto that in a little bit. They didn't have to participate in military service because that required making vows of allegiance to the emperors. And they learned that the Jews would rather die than do that. They considered that very odd that you'd be willing to give up your life for the sake of not making a little sacrifice to the emperor. But they found to their cost that the Jews would rather do that. And so they had were granting these privileges to the Jews. And initially they did that to the Christians as well, came in as Jews. But although the gap between the Jews and the Christians really separated widely after the first Jewish revolt, there continued to be some distinctively Jewish Christians, particularly in the East, that lingered on. And in some ways, sort of the debate about Judaism and Christianity lingered on for quite a while, even in the West, particularly over the date of Easter. And we'll get into this when we look at the church councils of the 4th and 5th centuries, because you had a group of people who wanted to keep Easter tied to the date of Passover, and then another group of people that wanted to completely separate that connection, so there was no sort of Jewish influence lingering on even in the church calendar. But there was a group called the Ebionites that lingered on in the East for several centuries. Ebionites, the Hebrew word Ebionim, means the poor. We have it a number of times in the Psalms. And they had some views that we would consider not orthodox. They accepted that Jesus was the Messiah, but not that he was divine. They believed that you had to keep the Torah, that being observant was a requirement for all Christians. And they didn't like Paul. They viewed that Paul was a heretic who had betrayed Torah, who had betrayed the Jewish law. And certainly we see that in Galatians and Romans. And they held very high regard for James the Just, James, who is viewed as the first bishop of the church in Rome, in Jerusalem, first leader of the church there, who even the Jews acknowledged as being a righteous man and observant. So these lingered on for many centuries, and finally they died out, the Ebionites. But it sort of reared its head again, because nowadays you have some Messianic Jews who are saying, well, maybe we should go back and actually be observant and keep Torah, and maybe we shouldn't emphasize the divinity of Jesus and emphasize the fact that he is a Jewish Messiah and emphasize that. So there's something called the Neo-Ebionite movement that's making a bit of an impact on messianic circles in Israel, which is not too good a sign. Okay, so that's Jewish attitudes. It didn't take too long. Within a few decades, the church and the Judaism went their separate ways, and you could no longer think of Christianity as a sect of Judaism. Now, unfortunately, what eventually happened is that Christianity got troubled by anti-Semitism and lost sight of the fact that it had Jewish roots, led to an ignoring of the Old Testament. It's important to emphasize our roots are in the Old Testament. We're grafted into the story that begins with Israel. Okay, so that's the Jewish attitude. The Roman attitude, the Romans thought that the Jews, they first of all considered Christianity also was a Jewish cult, and hence considered it to be legal. But within a few decades, persecution arose, and as that persecution developed, it became clear that, though there was rarely an official ruling on this, it became clear that Christianity was viewed as an illegal religion, and the term that was used for that is religio illicita, so an illicit cult. And that would last until the year 312, when we get the Edict of Toleration issued by Constantine, and things really changed. Now, the Romans viewed the Jews as strange, and they viewed the Christians as even more strange for a number of reasons that to us would seem a little odd. First of all, they viewed both the Jews and the Christians as atheists. And we would think, no, wait a minute, it's the other way around. They were atheists because they didn't believe in all the pagan gods. To the Roman mind, it was inconceivable that you only believe in one god. In fact, the way Roman religion worked was you had Roman gods, whom they had taken from the Greeks, and then as they conquered various peoples, you just sort of absorbed their gods. And so when they conquered Egypt, they brought in the Egyptian gods, Serapis and Isis, and built temples for them in Rome, and sort of the more the merrier. But Christians, Jews and Christians both had this insistence, no, there's only one God. And they had learned from the Jews that the Jews were willing to die for that insistence on monotheism. Rather than deny the Shema, they would recite the Shema, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is, Lord is one." And that for them was a life and death issue for the Jews. And then secondly, as why they viewed them as atheists, is that both the Jews and the Christians did not participate in emperor worship. And in the first century, the empire ran largely on emperor worship. Julius Caesar had dabbled with this idea that he was divine, and then subsequent emperors did claim that they were divine. Loyal citizens, loyal residents of Rome were required to offer up an offering of incense to the genius of the emperor. Sort of the spirit of the emperor as God. And the Jews refused to do this, and so they were allowed instead, because again, the Romans had learned that the Jews would die for this rather than compromise this, were allowed instead just to pray for the peace of the empire. And initially that was extended to Christians, but then we'll find that stopped happening, that indulgence. But the Romans could never understand why the Jews and the Christians would refuse to do what to them seemed an innocent enough thing, to offer put some incense on the fire and just acclaim Caesar as Lord and God and so on. The second thing they viewed them as atheists, they viewed them as a dangerous fifth column. Because the Roman Empire, the success of the Roman Empire, at least this is the way Roman religion went, was it depended upon keeping the gods happy. The Pax Deorum, the peace of the gods. So you had to keep the religious system working on with all the temples functioning properly and all the sacrifices going on to ensure success. And we'll see that what would happen later is that in times of crisis in the Roman Empire, the Christians then became a convenient scapegoat because it was viewed, well, they're the ones who are disturbing the peace and not keeping the gods happy. And then later on, after the fall of Rome, Augustine will write his book, The City of God, in order to defend against the critics who say, well, the reason that Rome fell was because the sacrifices to the gods had ceased. And he writes that great book to argue against that claim. The second main thing they were accused of was being antisocial, which is, again, is a little odd because the Christians, so much of the New Testament apostles, talk about being a social people, engaging with people and how you live with other people. But they were antisocial because they refused to participate in a lot of things that went on. They refused to participate in the imperial cult. They refused to join the trade guilds, which ended up being costly for them because that meant they couldn't participate in many of the trades. But joining a trade guild, participating in trade guild, meant participating in feasts in the temple of the patron god, patron deity of that guild, and eating food sacrificed to idols that in several places in the New Testament is warned against. They refused to go to the spectacles, so the games, the gladiatorial combats and all of that, which, again, the Romans find very odd. They wouldn't serve in the military because serving in the military required making an oath of allegiance to the emperor, what the Romans called a sacramentum, which would eventually carry over into our word sacrament. Next, they came to think that the Christians were cannibals because they kept hearing these reports that in their meals, the Eucharist, they would eat flesh and drink blood, and they couldn't understand what they were doing. And then they thought, came to think that they were guilty of incest because they would refer to one another as brother and sister and exchange this holy kiss of peace and have these love feasts, these agape feasts, that they thought were rather odd, wondering if they were orgies. So those are some of the attitudes of the Romans towards the Christians. They just thought them a very strange people and a potentially dangerous element within society, a destabilizing influence within society. And therefore, at times of trouble, the Christians were targeted. And persecutions would break out. And the first persecution that broke out by the Romans was under Nero. It was a very localized persecution just within Rome. Tacitus, a Roman historian, tells us about this. There was a fire in Rome. Most of you will know the story. And Nero blamed the Christians, although there was widespread suspicion among the Romans themselves that it was Nero who started the fire because he wanted to burn down a large part of Rome, clear the way for grand building projects. And so he blamed the Christians and engaged in a very violent local persecution of them, put a lot of them to death in very brutal ways that made even Tacitus, this Roman historian, take pity upon the Christians and say and write that many pitied them. But that was localized, wasn't empire-wide. Another wave of persecution broke out in the early 90s when Domitian was the emperor. He ruled from 81 to 96, and the first half of his reign was fine. Second half of his reign, he degenerated until finally he got so bad that the Romans viewed him as Nero come back to life, a second Nero. And he took to calling himself Lord and God, and calling on everybody else to call him Lord and God. And temples to him were built, notably one in Ephesus, for the imperial cult, for the worship of Domitian as Lord and God. And I think that's the backdrop for the writing of the book of Revelation. And a lot of others would take it as that. Those who disagree with that take Nero as being the backdrop for the writing of Revelation. Either way, it's Nero or Nero number two. And it's the backdrop is this emperor worship. And Christians who refused to do that then ran into trouble. This is probably what has to do with why John was exiled onto the Isle of Patmos, and then there were other Christians who were killed. When Domitian was assassinated, so fortunately he was finally deemed so bad that one of his Praetorian Guard killed him, sanity then returned to the Roman Empire for a while, and the next few emperors had thought it was completely ridiculous that you should think of yourself as a god. But then there was another outbreak of persecution in the time of Trajan. And this is in the second decade of the second century. And we have a series of letters that were written by Pliny, who was the governor of Bithynia on the south coast of the Black Sea, writing to Trajan, saying, so I've got these Christians, and they've been sort of denounced to me, probably by Jews, denounced to me. What do I do with them? So here's what I do with them. I interrogate them, and I give them the opportunity to recant, and I give them the opportunity to offer worship to you as the emperor. And if they recant, fine, I let them go. If after a few opportunities to do that, they don't recant, then I kill them because of this obstinate refusal to honor the emperor. And Trajan wrote back and said, yeah, that seems a fine course. Don't go out of your way to seek them out. But if they are brought to your attention, give them the opportunity to recant and to make this sacrifice. And if they don't, then kill them for their obstinacy, basically. So the issue there, as it was under Domitian, was do you honor the Caesar as God? So a way we can put that is, who is Lord? Who is Kyrios? Is it Christ is Kyrios or Caesar is Kyrios? And that became the issue for the Christians. What seems to be the picture is that, right there, the local Christians were usually unwilling to kill Christians. That should be the local officials. Local officials were generally unwilling to kill Christians because, other than thinking the Christians were odd, the Christians were, or that they were potentially a fifth column, the Christians were generally peaceable. But if push came to shove, and it was always over this issue of emperor worship, then they would kill them. So, yes, it was persecution. It was sporadic. It wasn't yet systematic, widespread persecution. Though certainly there were plenty of martyrs. And then what we think of as being the typical persecution that we think of that might have happened throughout the Roman Empire actually really only happened in the 3rd century. And there were several outbreaks of very intense persecution under the emperors Decius and Diocletian. The worst being under Diocletian. That one was so bad that it's called the Great Persecution. This was right at the end of the 3rd century. These emperors went out of their way to hunt the Christians down and kill them in large numbers. Fortunately, they were relatively short, but a lot of people were killed, and it was systematic. Part of the reason for this is that in the 3rd century, the Roman Empire really was falling apart. There were a lot of threats. The empire was destabilized. There were threats from Germanic tribes on the north. There were threats from the Persians on the east. And in time of trouble, you look, well, what can we do to appease the Roman gods? The Roman gods are obviously not being treated well. It must be the Christians. And so it would be a little akin to what we have had recently in some places. In time of trouble, you look for scapegoats, and often Christians, you know, I think of Indonesia back in 1997 and 98, when the Asian economic crisis hit, and look around for scapegoats, and the Christians, mostly Chinese, were wealthy, and they became the targets of violence, and churches were burnt down, and Christians were killed. So that's what would happen in the Roman Empire. And it was to then also to try and restore the worship of the Roman gods and get the empire back onto a stable footing, which, of course, that wouldn't happen because it was too late for that. The Roman Empire was rotten and falling apart. So during these persecutions, we have martyrs. The word martyr means a witness. And these faithful witnesses were faithful even to the point of death. Stephen is the first martyr. Read of him in Acts chapter 7. Other notable ones, in the book of Revelation, we read of Antipas, a martyr who has died, being put to death in Pergamum, following in the footsteps of Jesus, who actually, in the book of Revelation, is viewed as the first martyr. And it becomes clear in Revelation that many other martyrs will die for their witness that in their worship of the Lamb. In about the year 110, Ignatius, the bishop of Antioch, is taken to martyrdom in Rome. And as he makes the long journey from Antioch to Rome, and again, it's over this issue of refusal to participate in emperor worship, he writes a number of letters to churches along the way. And we have we have a number of those letters. So they're valuable documents of the apostolic fathers. He was actually quite eager to go for his martyrdom. He viewed this as an honor from the Lord. In the year 155, 156, Polycarp, the bishop of Smyrna, what is today Izmir in Turkey, was martyred at the age of 86. And again, he was given the chance. He was betrayed to the Roman authorities by Jews, and the Roman officials gave him the chance to deny Christ and to acclaim the emperor. And he refused to do that. He says, for 86 years, I've served my Lord. He's never done me any harm. Why now would I betray him? Those of you who've been with me to Turkey, have been into the church commemorating Polycarp, seen a recent a painting up on the ceiling honoring his death. So we have these accounts, and with Polycarp, we have a full account of his martyrdom. I have a document written about him, the Martyrdom of Polycarp, written shortly after. As these martyrdoms took place, more and more of them happened, the martyrs began to be honored, and they got viewed as, already by the year 200, we know that on the anniversaries of their death, which was viewed as their birthday, their birth into heaven, the Christians would gather at their tombs and hold commemoration services. And this led, many of these tombs would lead to those tombs becoming cultic sites, becoming church buildings, martyrion, or martyrdom, martyr honoring place, as it were. In Hierapolis, near Laodicea in Turkey, there's one for St. Philip, high up on the mountain. When I said St. Philip, that's another thing that happened, is that the martyrs began to be viewed as special Christians who had been so devoted to the Lord, they were willing to die for that faith. And this began to lead to viewing them as special, and eventually out of that grew the cult of the saints and the martyrs. So that has its origins in this being tested even to the point of death and remaining loyal to the Lord.
That's still the case in today's Catholic Church, right?
Not in the... Well, many of the saints who are honored, the early saints, were martyrs. But now it's all changed. You have to be a saint. It's got to be proven that two miracles have happened as a result of a faithful Catholic praying to that saint, and then a miracle happening. So it's completely changed as to what the qualifications are for being a saint.
Their position in the church, in the Catholic Church, I see the same, right? So that saint compared with the martyr, the saint of the martyr.
Yes, well, they're viewed as being, yes, as being the same status, being saints, just like the martyrs. And this all has to do with the saints. I mean, why do you pray to the saints? This is later theology that comes in the Catholic Church, having to do with this excess of merit and so on.
Is this tradition also honored by the Orthodox Church?
The Orthodox honor the martyrs, yes. They don't have the same idea of making more and more saints today. They honor the martyrs and really are more, probably actually more conscious of doing that than the Catholics are. And then out of this, the Romans found that as they killed more and more Christians, the church continued to grow. And in about the year 200, Tertullian, who was in North Africa, what is today Algeria or Tunisia, converted as an adult. He was a lawyer, very sharp mind, and he wrote an apology for the Christian faith, and he wrote it to the emperor. And he addressed the rulers of the Roman emperor, and he wrote this. You may be familiar with it. I quoted this a couple of times when I was preaching on Revelation. We are but of yesterday, and we have filled every place among you, cities, islands, fortresses, towns, marketplaces, the very camp, tribes, companies, palace, senate, forum. We've left nothing to you but the temples of your gods. The oftener we are mown down by you, the more in number we grow. the blood of Christians is seed, in which we developed the famous saying, the blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church. So he's saying, Christians are spread everywhere. The only place you won't find us is in your temples. You know, we're everywhere else. The more you try to kill us, the more hopeless it will be for you, sort of thing. It's then striking that the most intense persecution broke out at the very end of the 3rd century, beginning of the 4th century, and then in the year 312, within just a few years, we get the Edict of Toleration issued by Constantine and the end of persecution of Christians. And Christianity at that point in the year 312 becomes a legal, tolerated religion. Within just 10 years of the worst persecution that there ever was. So rapid has that changed. Now, sadly, what that then is going to lead to, and the verdict is out as to whether Constantine's a good person or a bad person, whether that was a good thing or a bad thing for the church, what will then happen is when Christianity becomes a legal religion, is the Christians will persecute each other. So unfortunately, it's not an end to persecution. It's just the target of that persecution changes. Okay, well, that brings us to the end then of what was happening in the West and attitudes to the Christians in the West. Any questions about that? Okay, I'm over to you to give you a break. Let's take a break for a few minutes. And then I want to go back to the East and look at what was happening in the Persian realm. Okay, as the church expanded east, we saw last week that quickly the Christians encountered three little kingdoms that lay between Rome and Persia. First one, Asrohene, with its capital in Edessa. I told you the legends of Thaddeus and King Abgar and this wonderful Mandylion, this image of Jesus, supposedly. Doubtful any historical reliability behind that. But legends arise because of something. And it's clear that Edessa became a center of Christianity very quickly. Then the next one over is Adiabene, another little kingdom with its capital in Arbela, Mon Erbil, the capital of Kurdistan today. That kingdom had converted to Judaism. The king had converted to Judaism in the first century. And then it eventually got absorbed into the Roman Empire. But Christianity took a hold there. And then in Armenia, which in the year 301, the king was converted, and that became the first Christian nation. And the Armenian National Church became the first national church in the world. Christianity and Armenia Armenia has maintained a strong Christian identity ever since. And then as the Christians moved further east and they moved out of the Roman Empire into the Persian Empire, we think of Roman roads which facilitated the spread of the gospel westwards, but there were a couple of important routes that enabled the spread of the gospel eastwards. Firstly is the Royal Road, or the Persian Royal Road, which was built, well, in its current state, it was built by Darius the Great, Darius the First. So this is back 500 BC. There were existing routes, but he turned it into a proper official route running from Susa, which is one of the Persian capitals, here at the edge of Mesopotamia, all the way up to Sardis. And those who've been to Turkey with me, we saw a portion of that road where it comes to Sardis. It's a number of feet down below the current road level. The Persians maintained that road, and they had stations along the way with fresh horses, and could send a messenger, a royal messenger, all the way from Susa to Sardis in just 9 days, a distance of 2,700 kilometers with regular changes of horses along the way. Herodotus was so amazed by this, the Greek historian from the 5th century, that he wrote about it, and he wrote about neither snow nor rain nor heat nor gloom of night stays these couriers from the swift completion of their appointed rounds, which then the U.S. Postal Service borrowed and uses today. So this road, the Romans took it over and continued to develop it, and this would have allowed anybody who wanted to move easily through Mesopotamia. It goes through the Cilician gates right here. So Paul probably would have walked along a stretch of this here on his second missionary journey. So the couriers could do the journey in 9 days with changes of horses. Otherwise, by foot, it would take 90 days to get from one to the other. But it was a remarkable achievement. And then the other significant road or series of routes that there were the Silk Road. The Silk Route, actually a sort of a little network of routes. Again, in Turkey, we've talked about the Silk Road that runs through the center of Anatolia. And then there was a branch starting here in Antioch and running down to the Persian capital of Ctesiphon. And then up through Central Asia, you could get all the way down to down into India. And that's probably what Thomas would have taken. So these two networks of road, and the Silk Road ultimately led all the way to China and down into India. And this is what the Christians ultimately would travel along. And using the Silk Road, Christianity got all the way to China by 7th century or so. The Chinese Christians have now launched a project called the Silk Road Project, which is basically to take Christianity back in the other direction along the Silk Road, back through all these Turkic republics of Central Asia and so on, all the way back to Jerusalem. Okay, there are three major Persian empires to talk about. Well, you know, I won't really talk about the first one very much. That's the one back in the days of Darius, the Achaemenid Empire, 550 to 330 BC. These are the Persians we read about in the Old Testament, that we read about in Ezra, Nehemiah, and Esther. 330, that came to an end thanks to Alexander the Great, who overran the world. There was no Persian Empire until 247, when a new dynasty, the Arsacid dynasty, was able to rise up against the eastern sort of reaches of Alexander's successors. And established this new dynasty, the Parthian Empire, that the Romans were never able to conquer. It was the one empire of their surrounding world they could never subdue. The border between Rome and Parthia roughly was the Euphrates, and the Parthians made several forays across the Euphrates to try and invade Roman territory. Some occasions got reasonably far, and this is why Herod the Great was so alarmed by these magi, wise men from the east, showing up asking where the new king is. Right, so during Herod the Great's reign, earlier in his reign, there had been Parthian incursions into the east end of the Mediterranean. So he was understandably rather nervous about that. In the year 224, the Parthian Empire came to an end, overthrown by the Sassanians or the Sassanid, who ruled for 400 years and sort of continued a bit of a power struggle between Rome and the Parthians, Rome and the Sassanids, the Byzantines and the Sassanids, as to exactly where that boundary went. They could never, the boundary would move back and forth, a couple of hundred miles or so. They could never outdo each other, never conquer each other, but they kept having these battles. And what was then going to happen is that by the early 7th century, the Byzantine Romans and the Sassanid Persians have just so exhausted themselves fighting each other that they sort of create a power vacuum for the Arab tribes to come up, the Muslim tribes to move north after the death of Muhammad and quickly overrun territory of both of them. But that's for a few weeks' time to talk about that. Okay, as the Christians moved east, they encountered some other religions. And the first one is Zoroastrianism, and this was the religion of these Persian empires. Zarathustra, or his Greek name, Zoroaster, was the founder of this, and he's back in the mists of time, some unknown date, but back before the first of those three great empires. he sort of consolidated the various gods of the Egyptian pantheon, harmonized them into a sort of somewhat monotheistic view, and said that there is one transcendent god, Ahura Mazda, and he created the world, and it was good. And then within the world, there are two opposing forces. There is the forces of good and of evil, and the force of good sustains Mazda's creation, and the force of evil seeks to destroy Mazda's creation. And within the world, there are operating these two mentalities, a sustaining mentality of good and the destructive mentality of evil. Mazda himself is not responsible for evil. He doesn't do anything evil himself. He creates a world that is good, but there is within it this force that is seeking to attack that. Zarathustra's ideas had then taken sufficiently hold that by the time the Achaemenid Empire got started, it was full-formed as a religion and got embraced by the Persians as their national religion and carried on. Zarathustra, perhaps most famous because, so Nietzsche wrote about the Sprach Zarathustra, which then Strauss turned into a piece of music, which then featured so prominently in 2001 Space Odyssey, right? That magnificent theme there is Strauss's Thus Sprach Zarathustra. There are still some Zoroastrians today under persecution from the Muslims. A lot of Zoroastrians fled from the Mesopotamian Iranian area and went down to northwest India, where they are the Parsis today. Perhaps the largest group of Zoroastrians. Part of the reason that Zoroastrianism is of interest is that there's quite a bit of speculation in some circles that as Judaism and Christianity came in counter with it, that some of the ideas from Zoroastrianism got picked up and incorporated into Jewish ideology and Christianity ideology, and especially this opposition between good and evil and this conflict that's going on within the world between good and evil. Second group, second religion that Christianity ended up coming in contact with is Manichaeism, named after Mani. And unlike Zarathustra, we do know when Mani lived. In the 3rd century AD, he was born into a Jewish-Christian home in Mesopotamia, and then he proclaimed himself as a prophet and a new prophet and styled himself as the apostle of Jesus Christ. And he basically started his own religion. He sort of somewhat based it as a blend of Judeo-Christianity and then of Zoroastrianism, and was initially viewed as a Christian heresy. This posited a outright dualistic cosmology, that there are two equal and opposite forces within the world, light and darkness, that the light is the realm of good, and it's the spiritual realm. Darkness is the realm that is evil, and it's the material realm. So some of you may recognize that as being Gnostic, and Gnosticism is something that the early church struggled a lot with in Greece, in the Greco-Roman world. This was an Eastern variation of it, this idea that the whole material world is fundamentally evil, that this created world is evil, and that what we should aspire to is to escape from this created world into the realm of pure being and the spiritual realm of good. So it's ultimately a denial of what scriptures say, which is the world that God created, the material world that God created, is very good. But early Christianity struggled a lot with this, and a lot of the early Christians were ascetic people, so into self-denial and into believing the world is fundamentally wrong, and our goal is to be freed from the prison of our bodies, and so the soul can be free and go up into the spiritual realm. Now, in the Greco-Roman West, that came from Neoplatonism, so a revival of Plato's ideas from Greece. But Manichaeanism was an Eastern version of this, and it spread very rapidly from Mesopotamia and Iran, or the Iranian area, westwards into the Greco-Roman world. And Augustine followed, was a Manichae for about 9 years. He got very enamored by this, and then was converted, at the end of those 9 years, was then converted to the Christian faith, and then became an outspoken critic of Manichaeism and wrote against it. But it lingered on. It took several centuries for Manichaeism to die out. It's different from Zoroastrianism in that Zoroastrianism doesn't say the world is evil. It would view the world initially as it's created as good, that Mazda created a world that was good, but there is an evil force within it, an evil mindset that is seeking to destroy that good world that needs to be restrained. And then because of that, Zoroastrianism isn't ascetic. It doesn't engage in all these ascetic practices denying the material realm and the physical realm. Third group, the Yazidis. Till last month, you had never heard of the Yazidis. But we then all got to hear about the Yazidis trapped on Sinjar Mountain. There's a little picture of them without any food or water. So this would be appropriate just to mention them, even though they're not a Christian group. They are, the Yazidis are considered, well, most would consider them Kurdish. They don't see themselves as Kurdish. They are, and the United Nations views them as a separate ethnic group. They are of Iranian origin. Kurds, by the way, tend to view themselves as being descended from the Medes, as of the Medes and the Persians, so similar sort of area. The Yazidi religion is sort of a syncretistic blend of all sorts of things. At its core, it's probably got ancient Persian religion, pre-Zoroastrian religion, blended in with bits of Zoroastrianism and Sufi, which is mystical Islam, and bits and pieces of other things. They are monotheists. They view that God created a world and placed it under the care of 7 holy beings, 7 angels, the chief of whom is Melek Taus, the peacock king, the peacock god, angel. But others accuse them of being devil worshippers, because non-Yazidis, and this would be Muslims, and then others you hear about them, and this was a lot in the news last month, that the Yazidis are the devil worshippers, that they, another name, that they confuse the peacock angel with Satan, and it's similar to the Muslim, somewhat similar to the Muslim story of Iblis, that out of which comes the whole the Muslim idea of Satan. And so they're accused of devil worship, and this is why the Islamic State goes after them, has gone after them. In their Islamic ideology, the Yazidis are not a people of the book. They're not an Abrahamic faith. Jews or Christians, they're pagans and deserve to be obliterated. Today, they're mainly up in Nineveh province, up there in the north of Iraq. Back to this map here. They were in Sinjar here, and the Islamic State captured the town of Sinjar, and so all the Yazidis had to flee up into the mountains up here, 50,000 of them, and were out there on this barren mountain without food or water in desperate straits. And then the Kurdish Peshmerga came in and helped free them, but also then airdrops by the U.S. and European forces and finally freed them. They don't view themselves as Kurdish. They actually, the Kurdish authorities are trying to make them, trying to impose on them a Kurdish identity. So they are sort of, in a sense, persecuted by the Kurds, who are trying to make them sort of a loyal part of Kurdistan. So that's what happened as the church encountered moving steadily east, remaining a Semitic church, then hit up against the next culture over, which is the Iranian culture, which is non-Semitic, completely different culture, different ethnicity, different languages, and so on, and those two worlds began to collide. Well, we have with us someone who is Iranian. So, would you like to come and introduce yourself to these fine people?
Sure. My name is Ari Forhar. And actually, it's an abbreviation. My full name is Ardashir. And Ardashir is actually in the Sasanian king's lineage. Mm-hmm. There were some kings named Ardashir. Mm-hmm. So that's my full name. Yes, sir.
Absolutely. There are no prepared remarks.
Right, I just saw Ari walk in this evening, and I said, well, I'm going to be talking about Persia tonight. I'm going to put you on. So.
Actually, Bernard, it was really interesting. I come from a Zoroastrian family, actually. So what you described, it was it's very refreshing. It doesn't happen often where I can hear about Zoroastrianism. One of the other things about Zoroastrianism is that the pillar of being good is emphasized. Mm-hmm. There's three things that are emphasized. Is one, you should have good thoughts, good words, and good deeds. Those are the good things that you should try to do. And the more good you do, good outweighing evil. It's a balance of scale. And it's really tough. Growing up in a Zoroastrian home, it was very difficult just reaching out to relatives and just sharing the gospel, because inherently we're good. And so that's the whole deal, is understanding the aspect of sin. And that we've all fallen short. It's kind of tough because, hey, we can just do more good. And at the end, the scales are going to tip in our favor. So that's been one of the difficulties, just to reaching to my family members, mm-hmm. and to my relatives, yeah. as well. Questions, Bernard?
So how did you become a Christian?
I came to the States at age 8 and grew up in the Midwest and was introduced to the gospel. I do recall that in Iran, the first Christian in our household was my grandmother, and my grandmother would take our entire family to church in Tehran on Fridays. Fridays are the equivalent of Sundays here in the U.S. That is the one day. That is the day off in the culture. So it's a 6-day work week and one day off. And so one of the things that blows the mind of first-generation immigrants is the concept of a weekend. A Saturday and a Sunday, it's 2 days off. Wow, it's amazing. And so Friday is when we went to church, and at that age, the influence of going to church was just very pivotal, going to Sunday school. And I was not ready at that time to fully grasp it or to fully accept it, but coming to the States, I heard the gospel, went to a church several times, and just was introduced to it, and accepted an altar call, mm-hmm. At age 12, and that's but those influences of going to Sunday school in Iran and then coming to the States is just mind-blowing. But everyone has a story, and it's a unique path that is designed specifically just for us.
Right. Can you tell us anything about the Christians in Iran and the state of the church?
Well,
what do we know?
Absolutely. Well, looking just in general, looking at myself, I'm a young adult in my 30s, single. There are a lot of people in Iran that would fit my category. Young adults, professionals, well-educated, with graduate degrees. Unfortunately, things are really tough right now. Population 72 million. Tehran is the city that I grew up in, and it's really think of New York, think of San Francisco, and or Los Angeles, one of the larger cities in the U.S. That's Tehran, and a lot of young people, very educated, and they love they want to be Western. they speak good English, they practice English, and so, but unfortunately, opportunities are not as prevalent as they could be. The engineer that we saw in the video, he wanted to stay in his, he's well-educated, but he wants to stay in his area, in Iraq, and other his peers have gone elsewhere. That's pretty much the situation, just a well-educated population, young people, and so and they're just really well-educated, and they are internet-savvy, and just, and whatnot. As far as the church is concerned, Bernard, it's the house churches, underground. Unfortunately, lots of persecution. The only church that was still open in Tehran was closed a few months back, I believe in May. So there are now no churches open in Tehran. And so it's all underground, and most of the teaching that comes is through satellite television. And so there's a lot of programming that that comes to the homes if people are daring enough to have dishes on the rooftops. And so you just really have to be creative. And but people are very bold. I think they're very attuned to the Holy Spirit, and they really are, and they're very bold. And I've had the privilege of interacting with some of those folks on a missions trip, not outside of Iran, and there's amazing stories, and there's just it's a whole conversation to be had. Mm-hmm. And so thank you very much, Bernard.
Right.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks so much, Hari. I am so glad you came tonight and that I saw you walk in the door. Any questions? Yes, Lois.
Is Hari connected with the Iranian church in Sunnydale?
Actually, the Iranian Christian Church in Sunnydale, that was the church that I grew up. When we first came to Northern California, I grew up at that church. And so Pastor Hormoz is well-affiliated with that church. He is now in Dallas, Texas, doing ministries there. And so there's a lot of great Christian organizations that are supporting Iranian ministries, like such as Voice of the Martyrs and some of the other organizations.
Let me pray to close. God and Father, thank you for Ari. Thank you for his grandmother and the influence that you had on him through her, through being taken to church, to Sunday school. And thank you that you brought Ari to yourself and incorporated him into your family and are now using him here. Pray that you pray for his family, that in their Zoroastrian ways, confident of their ability to do good, and to help in this sort of cosmic battle to ensure that good outweighs evil, that you would use Ari's life to reveal the gospel to them, and that you would use him into that family, into his family. We thank you for this long heritage of Christians in the Middle East, throughout these lands, and we are saddened, are grieved to see the loss of these Christians. We pray that those who are there, that you would preserve them, you would give them courage. We pray for the pastors and the bishops and the leaders who have courage enough to face even martyrdom, that you would enable them to shepherd their flocks who are under such great pressure and fear. That you would give them confidence in you and fill them with your Holy Spirit, give them compassion, give them wise words of counsel in that shepherding ministry, which is so needed at this time. I pray for those who are seeking to be bridge builders and reconcilers, that you, and to reach out into the surrounding religious communities, that you would bless that endeavor. And we commend them to your care in Jesus' name. Amen. Okay, next week we'll move on and begin to look at the Byzantine Empire. So beginning with Constantine, and we'll be on that at least 2 weeks, maybe 3 weeks. And in the course of that, we'll also then look at what's the Orthodox Church all about, what are the church councils about, what are icons about, all sorts of things like that. Okay, so see you next week.